Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, March the 27th. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along and hope you will join in this hour as we talk with the author of Regime Change, U.S. Strategy Through the Prism of 9/11. We'll talk about whether the U.S. should counter the dangers of weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, and rogue states by toppling regimes. And we'll wonder, why did the U.S. choose a military invasion to topple Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq? And what does that say about the impending crises with Iran and North Korea? How has U.S. foreign policy changed since the September 11th terrorist attacks? We'll talk with our guest, and we will welcome your questions and thoughts for him at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. Our guest is Robert Litvak, Director of the Division of Internal Security Studies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and former Director for Nonproliferation on the National Security Council staff. And as I mentioned, he is the author of the new book, Regime Change, U.S. Strategy Through the Prism of 9/11. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
What exactly do you mean by regime change?
Well, I, by way of context, I wrote a book in 2000, which was a critique of where this term rogue state came from. And the impetus for my new book was the September 11th attacks and the shift in the Bush administration's policy from containing these states to changing their regimes. The book traces that shift in policy and the implications through cases like Iran, Iraq, and Libya. But to go directly to your question, as we've seen in the case of Iraq, there's a big difference between decapitation, that is, toppling a regime, and actually building durable institutions that can follow on in the aftermath of that change.
Yeah. Well, we've actually learned of your book in a column in the New York Times, a Thomas Friedman column.
Yes.
And we thought that our listeners would enjoy talking to you. But as he put it, he said, watching the Bush team wrestle with Iran, North Korea, and Iraq reminds me of something that used to be said of the Reagan administration. The right hand never knew what the far right hand was doing. Is that how you see this?
Well, I don't know if I'd put it exactly that way, but I think that after September 11th, there was a redefinition of the threat, and whereas containing these rogue states, and I've never the purpose of my first book was to show how that formulation and the categorization really led to an inadequate understanding of those states. But the term is used by the President of the United States and his administration. So when I use it, I'm using it because that's the term that they used to describe these states. In the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, the perception of the threat was redefined, and you had those in the administration arguing that containment would no longer do it, that the behavior of these states derived from their very characters. You had it led to this shift from containment to regime change. And just to continue that thought one second further, the subtitle of my book is Through the Prism of 9/11, and that phrase comes from Donald Rumsfeld, who acknowledged that there was no new information about Iraq, but rather that they were looking at old information through the prism of 9/11, and that led them to conclude in 2002 that to pursue a regime change option rather than to continue the containment of Saddam Hussein.
Yeah. Well, so did the experience with regime change in Iraq, as we are seeing it now, change any minds or perceptions when it comes to Iran and North Korea?
I think the judgment that people make about Iraq is viewed by the outcomes that we've seen. That if there had been a decent post toppling of Saddam, plan, and if they'd found weapons and they'd done a myriad of other things, There's a lively debate about whether this whole thing could have been put on a different trajectory or not. But that said, we are where we're at, and the country's turned against the war. The assessment in public opinion polls, and I think it's shared in the foreign policy decision-making community, Congress and beyond, is that the costs have outweighed the benefits of it. So that the kind of in April 2003, after Saddam was toppled, there was talk from the administration that Iraq represented a type, a model. No one's talking that way anymore, given the outcomes in Iraq and the intractable sort of environment that we face in Iran and North Korea. Now, in my book, I also discussed the Libya model. Now, Libya was not a member of the Axis of Evil, and it was viewed in a different way by the Bush administration. And in that case, you recall there was a deal with Gaddafi in December 2003 where he gave up his weapons programs. The Bush administration claimed that as a dividend of the Iraq war. The officials would say that Gaddafi was scared straight by the Iraq experience. But the analysis in my chapter on Libya points in a different direction, and that is that the crux of the deal with Libya was a willingness to take yes for an answer. That is, if they gave up their weapons, that the United States would not target Gaddafi for regime change. And that was the key element, the security assurance. And I think where we're at with Iran and North Korea is that we can't replicate the Iraq model because of all the constraints I mentioned. And it's not clear that we would offer them the Libya model, and at the core of that deal was a security assurance, because the administration officials have said, really strong statements like, we don't negotiate with evil, we defeat evil, categorizing them as part of an axis of evil. After Baghdad fell, one administration hardliner said that the lesson of Iraq for Iran was, the quote was, take a number. So we're caught between these two precedents. We can't do Iraq. We won't offer them the Libya deal. And my book explains, and analyzes some of the implications that might flow to that. But the argument that the Tom Friedman column picked up on, that comes from my book, is that we've had this unresolved contradiction in our policy. Are we trying to change the regime? Are we trying to change their behavior of these countries? And as long as that contradiction persists, it's going to distort policy and lead to essentially an incoherence.
Yeah. Let me. We already have callers lining up,
yeah.
So let me take our first caller, who is John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hello. Well, I see the war on terrorism as primarily just another cover, like stability or war on drugs or war on communism, as a rationalization for American realpolitik. In Bush's administration, he assisted in overthrowing Aristide in Haiti, Chavez in Venezuela. They weren't linked to terrorists at all. Rationally, after 9/11, they could have gone after Saudi Arabia, but we've been in with, like Flint, with them since the 30s with Aramco. They could have gone after Pakistan, but Pakistan has nuclear weapons. We went after Iraq because Hussein was giving oil favors to Russia and China, and he would have excluded the United States. So that's a big part of what we're doing, and regime change certainly plays into it. But the big thing is, the UN does not allow regime change as a reason for unilateral action. It allows war and threat of war only as a unilateral action. Otherwise, everything has to go through the Security Council. And by our Constitution, since we signed on to the UN Charter, what Bush did was absolutely illegal. And the last point I'd make is, if we say regime change is okay for the U.S., should the rest of the world be able to change our regime when we support administrations like terrorist groups like the Contras? Or just yesterday, I read in the New York Times that Uribe, top general, was coordinating his attacks on Medellin with a paramilitary group that the U.S. had declared as terrorist, and we're supporting Uribe. We sent over $1 billion in the last couple years to Uribe. So the point is, this is contradictory, and it's illegal, and to a large measure, it's just another faction of American realpolitik.
Well, thanks very much for that question. There's a lot in it. Let me try to sort of disaggregate it into into pieces to respond to it. First of all, I think that a term or a phrase like the war on terrorism has become a kind of bumper sticker that has obscured our understanding. One of the issues you point to is the problem of so-called passive sponsors of terrorism, like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, that are notional allies of the United States, and how do we put pressure on them to no longer turn a blind eye to things that are happening on their territory? This is a very problematic sort of category. Most of our attention is focused on the state sponsors of terrorism, the usual list, Iran, Syria, etc. But the passive sponsors problem is really is a key one, and of course most of the majority of the hijackers came from, none of them came from Iran or Iraq. They came from Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So point one is this a challenging problem of passive sponsorship of terrorism. A second point, and that was running through your question, is the issue of intervention and state sovereignty. And this is a question that's perennially wrestled with in international relations, in international law. In 1994, the UN Security Council set a precedent when it permitted an international intervention in Haiti. That was a big event. One could contrast the cases that President Bush 41 and President Bush 43 took to the UN Security Council and the contrasting way in which the issue of sovereignty kind of played through there. Bush 41 had a much easier time after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait to get an international consensus, because the argument there was to essentially restore Kuwaiti sovereignty that had been negated by Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. In a sense, Saddam murdered another state in 1990 when he invaded, and it was easy to get an international consensus to overturn that aggression. By contrast, Bush 43 went to the UN and argued much more difficultly that the United States needed to negate Iraqi sovereignty, that is, overthrow the Saddam Hussein regime in order to achieve compliance with Security Council resolutions. And that was always going to be a much tougher sell. And that leads me to my third point, which is because the United States after 9/11 has acted outside international institutions and the norms of the system, because it's felt threatened, and we can debate, you know, sort of this, whether this perception of vulnerability and the causes of it are real or not. But that was the impetus behind the unilateral action in Iraq. And what's seen in the aftermath of that is that the United States has become the issue in international relations. One's impressed in a variety of different policy contexts how the United States has become the issue. Look at the speech that President Putin gave in Germany and the kind of resonance that's had. Even someone like an Ahmadinejad in Iran, who's so virulently anti-American and has created the kind of perception that he has in Western countries, but see the resonance he gets in the Middle East with this sort of anti-American message. And that's testimony to how, in the post 9/11 period, we've gone from when Le Monde, the French newspaper, would say we are all Americans, to the point where you've had like widespread anti-Americanism, and America has become the issue. Sorry for a long-winded answer.
Well,
there were a lot of parts to it, so I just wanted to address the different ones. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, John, for the call, and we will continue talking with Robert Litvak. He is author of Regime Change: U.S. Strategy Through the Prism of 9/11, 1-800-642-1234 or 263-1890 if you have a question for him. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6. Household incomes are dropping faster in Wisconsin than in any other state, and Ben's guest after 5 says, it's not the economy, but a social and demographic shift that has put Wisconsin at the bottom of this list. More about that during At Issue with Ben Marins after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We are talking about regime change, wondering whether the U.S. will continue to or should counter the dangers of weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, and failed states by toppling regimes. we will wonder why the U.S. Chose to overthrow Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and what that means for the looming crises with Iran and North Korea. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our guest is Robert Litvak, who is author of Regime Change, U.S. Strategy Through the Prism of 9/11. The Friedman column also pointed out, Mr. Litvak, that you say that the Bush administration does not have clear policies and it has competing impulses when it comes to North Korea and Iran. What do you mean by that?
Well, this really goes to the heart of what my book is about, that when I say competing impulses, what one's had is this persistent, unresolved contradiction of those who, within the administration, is our objective to change the regime, or would we settle for changing behavior? Late last week, John Bolton, the former outgoing U.N. Secretary, ambassador to the U.N., the United States outgoing ambassador to the U.N., explicitly stated that the United States should pursue a regime change policy toward Iran, and that was the only way to resolve the nuclear question. And the focus of my book is that this unresolved contradiction frustrates our policies in dealing with Iran and North Korea, because when you make the issue the survival of the regime, you transform the stakes. You don't give them any incentive to give up their programs. In fact, the belief that they're targeted by us, you know, for regime change, indeed gives them an incentive to accelerate their programs. Now, in the case of Iran, there's a debate inside Iran. Iran has real politics. I mean, that is an extremely complicated society where you have reformists who are now, you know, since President Khatami left office and was replaced by this radical Ahmadinejad, the reformists are down but not out. You also have pragmatic conservatives who are open to who want to continue Iran's nuclear program as a civil nuclear program, but are open to a deal. And then the radicals who really reject it. And one seen in Tehran from those who relying on those who are kind of really expert Iran watchers is a debate inside Iran. As Henry Kissinger put it, Iran has to decide whether it wants to be a cause or an ordinary state. And the bottom line of my book is that if we resolve the contradiction at our end, that is, make it clear that we would accept a behavior change and would fall off of the objective of regime change, we really put the onus on them to have to make a tough choice. But as long as we keep flirting with the fantasy of regime change, and making that the objective, it really frustrates our ability to get the deal. For example, in the UN Security Council debate, the Russians, because of the Iraq experience, wanted to be very clear that there would be no language in there that the United States could then cite as a predicate for attacking Iran's nuclear facility. So you see how the question of regime change frustrates our ability to get allied support for meaningful measures, and keeps the onus, puts the focus on Washington rather than on Tehran or Pyongyang.
Let me get another caller in. Linda, yeah, in Monroe. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Mr. Litvak.
Good morning.
I'm currently reading the book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time by Antonia Juhas. It's very, very informative. And she says in there that we're doing this for the oil and that the multinational corporations want to take over the world. She said in there that President Bush wants to privatize the oil in Iraq. He wants 70% of the profits, and he wants 30-year contracts. Now, I don't think that the Iraqi people will buy that, not when their oil is presently owned by the government.
Well, you don't. Do you think that the U.S. wanted to topple Saddam Hussein or wanted the oil, Robert Litvak?
Look, I think it's, you know, you can have economic, you know, conspiracy theories to kind of explain the behavior. And, of course, the United States, like any other, you know, country, will tend to its own interests. But the reality is more complicated than that. I mean, the United Nations had inspectors in Iraq in the 1990s, the UNSCOM inspectors. And we know from the report issued by Charles Dulfer, who was the head of the Iraq Survey Group that went into Iraq afterwards to uncover or to explain the absence of WMD in Iraq, And they interviewed Saddam Hussein, Tariq Aziz, and they'd had contact with, in the case of some of the inspectors, had had contact with high-level Iraqi officials. And the story of the 1990s with Iraq was the Iraqi officials on many occasions approached the Americans and said, how can we become your best friend in the Gulf? We're a secular state. You want access to oil, we'll guarantee it. You want to negotiate the price, we'll negotiate the price. So if it was just about oil, if there was sort of a one single explanation for it, the counterfactual is, well, why didn't they just cut a deal with Saddam Hussein, a secular tough guy, to get secure oil at a reasonable price? In fact, that's the deal he put on the table after he invaded Kuwait to try to allay Western fields. So I think that analyses that just point to single factor conspiracy theories, like it's just about oil, the reality is more complicated.
Yeah. Help us understand really what it was about.
I think it was, the transformative impact of 9/11. I mean, Al-Qaeda blew up Wall Street and the Pentagon. It has the most searing psychological impact on U.S. public, since the Cuban Missile Crisis or the Kennedy assassination. Really left to this change in perspective. Now the question is, why Iraq, which was contained and had there were some questions about the status of its whether there were some residual WMD capabilities or not. Why Iraq versus North Korea, which had a more advanced program,
right.
Or Iran, which was viewed as a more dynamic a threat, and there are explanations offered for that. That have to do with that Iraq has been called kind of a low-hanging fruit and that it was viewed as a residual kind of issue from the 1990s. You know, the tough critique of the Iraq invasion is that it was a diversion from the real, so-called war on terrorism, that the people who did the attacks and escaped in Afghanistan to this hinterland in Pakistan. But I would put more of a focus on in my book, I put more of the focus on 9/11 and the change in security perspective that sort of fed into the shift from containment to regime change in the case of Iraq. And that was encapsulated in that title, the subtitle of the book, Through the Prism of 9/11, which is a Rumsfeld phrase.
Right. But we've heard so much that they're trying to link, the administration was trying to link Iraq with Saddam Hussein, with Osama bin Laden and mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda, and that didn't really hold up.
Well, in the book I go through, there were two routes that the administration was sort of simultaneously pursuing to basically get to the intervention in Iraq. One was a route that was consistent with international law and working through the Security Council. I mean, if one looks at the speech that Prime Minister Blair gave in the Commons just before the invasion in 2003, it was totally consistent with international law. Blair argued Saddam Hussein's been flouting Security Council resolutions, and if the Security Council doesn't uphold those resolutions, the UN will become a feckless kind of League of Nations, and there was ambiguity about Saddam's weapons programs. What one finds from the Iraq Survey Group that I alluded to previously is that Saddam cultivated ambiguity about his programs mm-hmm. because he felt there was utility in ambiguity, that he could eke out some deterrence against the United States and Iran and impress his own people inside. The big conundrum about Iraq's WMD programs is, well, why didn't he just come clean if he didn't have anything? If he'd just thrown open the country for real, no holds barred inspections of the kind that Gaddafi agreed to, he could have deprived the United States of its main rationale for war. Now, Hans Blix and the UNMOVIC inspectors got in there in January, February, there was some better compliance, but it was fitful. And I argue in the book that he was never going to be completely transparent about it and come clean because he saw that there was utility in it. And he thought that that ambiguity could maybe deter the United States from attacking. Now, just one final point about the ambiguity. It was a hedged this question of ambiguity in the sense of there was legitimate ambiguity that derived from the UN inspector's final report. In January 1999, UNSCOM, the UN inspectors, issued a final report in which they said, here are the open accounts. Here's all the documents we know of what they brought in from the Soviet Union, chemical weapons, some biological medium, etc. Here's what they have not accounted for the destruction of. And that was really the known issue, the known kind of ambiguity, and the known unknown, that the known part of the WMD issue that the Iraqis had to reconcile. The hype came in on the links to al-Qaeda and the nuclear piece of it. And that's where the administration, you know, claimed operational links that the 9/11 Commission said did not exist, and also that some aluminum tubes, recall those, that had been imported were part of an attempt to revive the nuclear program. So I distinguish between the legitimate ambiguity, that is, the unresolved questions from the UN inspectors, and the hype. And the question, you know, I leave is, you know, it's a totally different question. Did the ambiguity that I don't think would have been resolved about Iraq's program rise to the level of leading to a preventive war? And I think people will disagree, you know, will disagree on that. And our judgment about it is based on, you know, the outcome of the war. I mean, the costs, the intractable insurgency and civil war. I mean, so much of judgments about intervention is based on kind of what the outcome was. And you can go back through the history of interventions that the debacle in Somalia led to reticence to get involved in Rwanda. The horror in Rwanda made it more likely that we'd get involved in Kosovo. Kosovo and the way that happened meant that when we went into Afghanistan, it was more likely that the United States would not want to be encumbered by working through NATO, but to do more on its own, et cetera, et cetera.
So, let me bring in Gary in Waterford. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. My point is very similar to what the author just made, is the fact that our initial intent in going into Iraq or confronting Iraq was not to regime change. It was not to go in there and attack Iraq. Our initial effort was to go in through the UN and ask for an inspection because of the fact that Iraq was thought to have possible weapons of mass destruction. And they felt that the sanctions were not sufficient, that we had to actually go in there and inspect, and Saddam Hussein refused to do that. As a result, the United States built up a military presence there, again, not with the purpose of attacking, but with the purpose to force the issue so the inspections could take place. And Hans Blix even said this, without the U.S. presence there, they never would have been able to get in there to make the inspections. And then once we got in there, Saddam Hussein called our bluff, and because he knew that we would not be able to maintain that force. And so there was a question whether we actually go in there or whether we back out. And it was felt that we could not back out. That was an opinion held by Tony Blair, Bush, and all the leaders of the free world at that time. And so that forced the issue, and we went in there because Saddam Hussein was not open as far as the inspection was concerned. And then that's one that evolved into a regime change type of program. But that was not the initial intent.
Is that how you read it?
Thank you for that that comment. I mean, I agree. There were two different routes by which the administration approached Iraq. One was consistent with international law and working through the Security Council, and the other was with reference to this elevation of military preemption that had occurred, you know, post 9/11, and the preemptive use of force is highly controversial in international law. It's permissible against an imminent threat, a truly imminent threat, but is not permissible against emerging threats and as a preventive option. And that's why there's been such a strong reaction to some of the rhetoric coming out of Washington and the action in Iraq. To the caller's comment, I think that I very much agree with the thrust of the comment that there was, whatever one's opinion about view on the outcome of the Iraq War, and I think there's a consensus that's emerging that it was that because of the consequences of it, it was it's been a disastrous move. But there was a defensible predicate for going in based on the Security Council resolutions. And my analysis is that Saddam was never going to come totally clean for the reason I stated in my previous answer, that he derived utility from it. He thought it was a useful instrument to him. Indeed, in 1991, he thought that Iraq's chemical weapons had deterred the United States in the 91 war from marching on Baghdad. So he wanted to hang on to it and to cultivate ambiguity. And I don't think another 6 months of UN inspections under Hans Blix would have resolved that, or not for the reason it would have been more fitful cooperation. Now, the question, did that rise to the level of launching the preventive war? Our view on that is based on sort of the disastrous outcomes that have come since. And, you know, the big question out there is, was that an inevitable outcome? Could different assumptions, a larger force, not disbanding the army, all the myriad of mistakes that have been alluded to in analysis, could that have put this on a different trajectory? But that's a different issue.
We are talking with Robert Litvak. He is director of the Division of Internal Security Studies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and the former director for Nonproliferation on National Security Council staff. He is the author of Regime Change, U.S. Strategy Through the Prism of 9/11. 1-800-642-1234 or 263-1890 if you have a question or thought about this. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. The leader of Northern Ireland's major Protestant and Catholic parties met face-to-face for the first time to negotiate a deal to share the government. Kathleen and her guest after 9 will discuss the significance of this meeting coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with the author of the book Regime Change, U.S. Strategy Through the Prism of 9/11, Robert Litvak, and our next caller for him is Saeed in Green Bay. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, and thank you very much for taking my call. I wanted to make the comment that the issue of regime change is really not the business of the American government or the American people. The issue of regime change is really the business of the Iranian people. And unfortunately, from the standpoint of the struggle that's going on inside Iran today, neither the American right or the American left has it right. The choice is on the American right to bring, freedom at the point of a gun, and on the American left it is to accommodate the Ayatollahs. And quite contrary to what your guest said, the real politic in Iran is not between Khatami and Ahmadinejad, two faces of the same regime. What animates Iranian intellectuals and the struggle inside Iran is liberalism. The real struggle is between people like Shirin Ebadi, human rights winner, the human rights lawyer who was the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, Akbar Ganji, the writer who's been in prison, and by the way, he was placed in prison under the rule of Khatami. The biggest disservice that the Western media does to the struggle to the cause of freedom in Iran is to call the likes of Khatami moderate. Khatami and Ahmadinejad are two different faces of the same exact regime. Yeah. What the people in Iran are struggling for is freedom. And the American left is quite confused in not showing the type of solidarity with the Iranian liberals that they showed to, for example, populist movements in Guatemala and Nicaragua and in South America. That's my comment.
Yeah, what do you think of that, Robert Litvak?
Well, there may be less disagreement with the speaker than his comment suggested. I think that a couple of points. Khatami and the reformists—they were enormous disappointment, both inside and outside Iran when Khatami took power as president. He was called Ayatollah Gorbachev. There was a sense that he might be able to change the regime and really to take on the role of the clerical power and the supreme leader. And his unwillingness to do that, and there were a number of key points, student demonstrations in the summer of 1999, deflated his supporters, and in the end, Hatemi, the judgment on him is really quite harsh, and you're close to what the caller said, which is he's just sort of the acceptable face of this regime. The Bush administration's, when you ask them what is one of my second point, and it sort of builds on that, and it relates to one of the main themes of my book. I talk about how the non-proliferation issue, dealing with Iran's sort of uranium enrichment program, et cetera, in the case of Iran, how it's embedded in the broader question of societal change in Iran. And the dilemma for us is that the nuclear question and the societal change question, they're on different timelines. They're not in sync. The Bush administration, the current, if you talk to, officials and say, what's your current concept of change in Iran? They'll say a civil society uprising from below that will topple the regime. And, in fact, the administration has requested $75 million to fund non-governmental organizations in Iran as part of this soft revolution option. And that's been highly contentious with reason, because U.S. government money, sort of tainting non-governmental organizations in Iran would make them be viewed as sort of foreign, agents of a foreign power, and sort of taint them politically. So the Iranian NGOs have been running, from that, have not been, running to take on, funding from outside of Iran. The dilemma is kind of what's the timeline for this type of civil society uprising? And can we wait for that to play out while the nuclear program is proceeding apace? Unfortunately, we've got to deal with a regime that's in power, not the one that we would hope is there. By making the regime the issue, in a way, it strengthens it by allowing the regime to play the nationalist card. So that if, for example, the United States were to bomb Iran's nuclear sites, the likely outcome, there's some in the administration who believe that it would be the starting gun of a counter-revolution in Iran, but much more likely is that it would lead to a rally around the flag effect, and you'd have people rallying to the mullahs who are standing up against the United States. So I appreciate the call in that it gets at this sort of linkage between the subtle and complex linkage between the societal change issue and the immediate question of the nuclear program.
Yeah. I'm wondering, since this is in the news, if you have any concerns over Iran taking those 15 British sailors hostage, saying that they were in Iranian waters when Britain says they were in Iraqi waters. Tony Blair yesterday said Britain is prepared to move into a different phase if diplomacy fails to result in the release of the soldiers.
Well, Iran believes itself to be it's an aggrieved party. It has a grievance against the outside world and how it's been treated by outside powers, including Britain in the sort of colonial era and in the contemporary era by the United States. And it feels not only aggrieved but also emboldened by the fact that the United States is bogged down in Iraq and is bleeding there, so to speak, literally. Under Ahmadinejad, who's been playing the nationalist card, they've undertaken a number of provocative actions, and the statements have been even more provocative, the Holocaust denial, et cetera, et cetera. In addition, there are multiple power centers within the regime, and sometimes it's not clear if they're acting in a coordinated way, so that the British sailors were taken by Revolutionary Guards. It's not clear kind of what the control linkage is between the different factions in the Tehran regime and the Revolutionary Guards. I'm hopeful that this will be resolved after some time through kind of a diplomatic process. But it points to the tensions and the possibilities for inadvertent escalation in that area, because you've got forces in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and an incident like this has the danger of escalation.
Midge in Madison is with us now. Hi, Midge.
Hi. I agree with you that we didn't go in it to buy the oil, because they would have made an agreement on that. What I think is this: every bit of evidence that they went in to control Middle East oil, You talk about it through the prism of 9/11. It wasn't anybody from Iraq that was involved in 9/11. They just used that for an excuse. It seems pretty evident that what they were thinking that was Iraq was such a weakened country that it would be easy to pick them off, and then they hoped that all the other countries would come along like Libya and just say, well, we're going to do what you want now, and they thought that would be a good way to intimidate people. Here we are with all these weapons, and everybody thought we wouldn't use them, and now we showed we would. The problem is that it hasn't made us any better off. We have spent our money and our sons, and we have lost respect in the world. Our economy's in trouble, and now we're talking about going into Iran and doing the same thing. I don't know when they're ever going to learn.
Well, I'll sort of let that stand largely as a comment. I think I responded in the previous question the two quick points that the subtitle of my book was, and the title of it is not a how-to or an endorsement of that as a strategy. Mm-hmm. Rather, it's trying to explain kind of why the shift from 9/11 to pre-9/11 strategy of containment and deterrence to a post-9/11 strategy of changing regimes. And the related second point is that change in perspective was attributable to the psychological kind of the impact of the 9/11 attacks in terms of shaping American perception of threat, and one can certainly differ with their diagnosis of the threat, but I come, so to speak, not to praise the policy, but to try to explain it, and then to tease out what are the implications of it in dealing with the hard cases down the line, like Iran and North Korea.
What about the implications of the end of this war in Iraq? What do you see happening there?
Well, I think two things. First, that whoever someone alluded to regime change, not just in these countries, but in the United States, and we do have things called elections and term limits. And in January of 2009, we'll have a new president. That new president, there's no one in the current field that's running that is arguing for sort of the continuation of the policies that mm-hmm. are currently being pursued. So I think the pendulum will swing back, and we will see. My prediction would be that we'll see a return to a more traditional type of policy, U.S. policy, one that is more focused on working through institutions. The second point, and this is a big unknown out there, is whether there will be a so-called post-Iraq syndrome, just as we had during after the Vietnam mm-hmm. War, of pulling back. And I don't think there's any after the interventions are judged by the perception or the characterization of the threat going in, but they're judged by the consequences going out, and in the end of it. And I think as people assess the outcome in Iraq, the cost, the direct cost of unilateralism there, both in blood, over 3,000 killed, and treasure in estimates upwards of $1 trillion. I think that there is not public support for further type of interventions of this type, and it remains to be seen whether there'll be even a domestic consensus for kind of an active foreign policy and remaining engaged. And for those who I have this concluding line in my book, I said for those who were highly critical of U.S. activism after 9/11 leading to the Iraq intervention, some may lament in the post-Iraq period the lack of activism.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there are widespread calls, let's do something about Darfur.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no support for, if the U.N. is unwilling to act, and the Darfur case shows the limits of the U.N. Security Council, because the Chinese and others will just veto any collective action in where a horror is occurring. And there you have humanitarian hawks, so to speak, people who want to intervene in places like Rwanda and Darfur. Yes, let's send in the 82nd Airborne, many of those people would have opposed the Iraq war, but they would support a humanitarian intervention. I think that the support domestically for this type of active role, whether it's dealing with proliferation issues, and I've outlined all the constraints on intervention in my comments, and it's laid out in my book, but also in dealing with these humanitarian cases where it's harder to make the case that direct U.S. interests are involved, but yet people will say something must be done. I think that it'd be hard to get support for those kinds of actions. And that would be, many people would lament that.
And David in Menominee, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been struck by the contradiction that you referred to between policy of regime change and policy of behavior change. And both those policies strike me as highly reflective of our arrogant imperialism that is not entirely new with the Bush government, but just kind of taken to a new level. And I wonder if there's anything to be said in the future of American foreign policy for a streak of humility, we might say, in which we take a look at our own behavior and how that impacts on other parts of the globe and treating nations as sovereign in their own right, and dealing with them as a citizen of the globe in some diplomatic, helpful, useful fashion that, backs away from our need to control everybody else's behavior to suit our particular interests.
Well, my first book that I alluded to, Rogue States and U.S. Foreign Policy, the critique of the rogue state concept and its translation to policy was that it was a unilateral American concept without standing in international law. And where in the current book, where I talk about this contradiction between regime change and behavior change, I point out how regime change is inherently problematic because it's viewed as subverting the sovereignty of another state. And here you have a character, Saddam Hussein. It's hard to imagine a more unsympathetic character. And yet look at all of the reaction to the proposal to march on Baghdad to enforce Security Council resolutions. So the issue of sovereignty makes the question of the objective of regime change inherently problematic. And that's why I focus on behavior change. And the behavior I'm talking about is not just behavior the United States doesn't like. Mm-hmm. It's behavior that violates norms of international relations. What Iran is doing is not violating some particular preference of the United States. It is violating its international responsibilities under the NPT. And as long as we can put ourselves on that side of the debate, and that means taking the regime change question off the table, we'll be much stronger, in a much stronger position to get international support. So that's really the focus of my book.
Yeah, and that's a good place for us to leave it. We're out of time. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Robert Litvak, author of Regime Change, U.S. Strategy Through the Prism of 9/11. Robert Litvak is also director of the Division of International Security Studies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He is the former director for nonproliferation on the National Security Council staff. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing this hour. Thanks to Steve Williams for on-air production. If you'd like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444, or listen online, wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.